It's not uncommon when we sort of have these cultural discussions about how the church should interact with culture per se, for someone to say, well, the Apostle Paul says that we should be all things to all people. So doesn't that suggest maybe in some way that we ought to adapt to suit culture?
Well, some people read it that way. I mean, there are certainly points of adaptation that would be appropriate, but he doesn't say that. Well, my favorite biblical book about culture is the letter to Titus, where Paul says, in summarizing the kinds of cultural obstacles to Titus's ministry, he quotes someone who had said, all Cretans are liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. Now, he doesn't tell Titus, to liars, you should be liars, to evil beasts, you should behave like evil beasts, to lazy gluttons, you should behave like lazy gluttons. Titus is a great alternative to the all things to all men, because the whole point of the pastoral guidance that Paul gives to Titus is, you know, you're living in a culture where people are just, they behave instinctually, they're not deliberate in their lives. Paul five times says that Titus is to encourage self-control. You live in a culture where people don't understand self-control. Self-control is a really important thing that you have to encourage. So I encourage people who think that we can kind of simply adapt to cultural change, to first of all ask, well, what's the nature and what's the reason behind the cultural change? Let me give you a good example. In the last 40 years, our culture has become more obsessed with informality, or maybe I should say we've become less sympathetic to the idea of formality in many ways, in patterns of dress, in patterns of eating, in the shape of relationships, in dance, in all sorts of things. Informality reigns. So, I mean, if you went to a baseball game in the early 1960s, men there would be in suits and wearing hats, you know, neckties, formal dress. You know, used to be that if you were my wife remembers when she was a girl, she and her mother were going to take the train somewhere. Well, you had to dress up to travel in public. You're going to be in public. So, okay. And that was just a general cultural standard expectation. That changed. It changed sometime in the 60s and 70s where, in fact, when designer jeans first came out, Jordache, which was one of the leading firms in selling designer jeans, had a really hard time selling women on the idea that it was okay to wear blue jeans in public. And that's, I think, late 60s. Within a decade, that had changed dramatically. And informality was and it has increasingly become the default position for almost every institutional setting. And churches have followed suit. In fact, a lot of times I'll look at a church's website and they'll stress the fact that we're an informal church. Come as you are. Well, so I want to ask, and I have asked, why did American culture change? What caused that change? What caused, as one guy I interviewed, what caused us to change our linguistic habits so that formal speech patterns, rhetorical speech, oratory, is almost unheard of, even in settings like presidential speeches or congressional speeches where it used to be assumed. Why did we abandon it? Well, the linguist I interviewed argues that the main reason informality, he wrote a book called Doing Your Own Thing, subtitled The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care, which is my favorite subtitle ever. And John McWhorter argues that the main reason America took this informal turn, this turn toward informality, was because formality requires a recognition of authority. When you behave in accordance with a set of manners in any kind of setting, in any way, you are submitting to a standard that's authoritatively established by someone. You didn't get to vote on whether or not you wanted to wear a suit and tie to the ball game. It's just what the standards require. He argues that beginning in the 60s, the American suspicion toward authority just ramped up immensely. So if, in fact, the change toward informality is a symptom of our suspicion of authority, and if, I would argue as a corollary, one way to nurture the dispositions of our young as well as of ourselves is toward the recognition that authority is a good thing, that authority is actually something that, and that hierarchies of standards is actually a good thing, is to maintain standards of manners of some kind, to maintain standards of formality and sets of expectations of formality. If in fact the idea of divine judgment is more plausible in a society that has standards of formality than in a society that has no standards of formality, why would the church think it's a wise idea to just go informal like everybody else has? Come as you are. Well, see, I don't think anybody who... I don't think people thought about it. I don't think people stopped and asked, why have we gotten more informal? And I think it wouldn't have been that hard to see that the move toward informality represented this suspicion of authority. There were people writing about it in the 60s who saw this. Church tended not to read, you know, Christian leaders tend not to read those sorts of folk, and tend also to say, well, unless, again, like I said before, if you're not breaking a biblical law, then it's okay. It's not realizing how the most important thing that cultures do is cultivate us. Cultures cultivate our dispositions. Cultures shape our inner assumptions and understandings. So to change from a pattern of formality to a pattern of informality is bound to, and has, I believe, changed the inner disposition of people in their attitudes toward authority. So, again, I think there's a case where, to take Paul's dictum, you know, all things to all men, he clearly didn't mean that comprehensively. The letter to Titus is clear evidence of that. In the context, he meant that he was not going to identify with Gentiles or Jews, as I recall. So obviously it had a limited, you know, throughout his letters, he's always warning people about the danger of being conformed to the world. In fact, at the pivotal point in the letter to Romans, chapter 12, when he says, therefore, having summarized the work of redemption with great complexity in the first 11 chapters, then he says, therefore, and starts the last five chapters of the book that go into the specific consequences of this theology. He starts by saying, you know, have your minds, you know, that you need to be transformed by the renewing of your minds and not be conformed to the world. There's so much in Paul where he clearly argues against simply mimicking a cultural status quo, that's a very superficial, careless reading of it to think that that's simply a blanket endorsement for again imitating cultural forms. I think I stress over and over that cultural forms are rarely arbitrary; they usually are embedded. They usually have a deep kind of meaning, and they don't change without, because cultures are like ecosystems, that a change in one place often means a change in other places. And if we don't look at the ecosystemic character of culture and start imitating cultural forms that aren't obviously problematic, then I think we end up endorsing things we really don't want to endorse.
Let me ask you one last question. You've recently written, to resist the disorientations of popular culture church leaders and their followers need to recover a rich theology and practice of the church as a people with a distinctive culture. Could you maybe tell us what would such a theology look like?
Yeah, well, first of all, American evangelicalism has characteristically been much, much more individualistic than the New Testament is. We tend to think of salvation as an individual thing. We've tended to have a really low view of the church, typically, and hence typically low views of sacraments and church discipline. So this is part of our, and again, I think that's because, well, I think it's in part because of a kind of a, I think it's in part because of the influence of the Enlightenment on American culture. The Enlightenment was, which was very much about resisting any kind of historically rooted cultural authority, and so very individualistic. So the idea that we are actually, that our identity as individual believers is never individualistic. It's always as members of a body. It's always as members of a people. That's kind of lost for a lot of Christians. In fact, the fact that more and more people are saying, I don't need to be a member of a church to be a believer. That's optional. That's exactly the wrong direction. And it's hard to justify that in light of the New Testament, especially since the Great Commission starts by talking about baptism. If you have any understanding of what baptism meant in the New Testament, it's not just an arbitrary individualistic symbol, a symbolic act. It's tied to the idea of becoming a member of the church, a member of the body. So I'd say that now, because of the fact that we're individualistic, most American Christians have a stronger sense of membership in America than they do in the church. I think most American Christians feel more like Americans who happen to be Christians than Christians who happen to be Americans. If you ask American Christians who they identify with more, their fellow Republican suburban neighbors or Christians from Iraq, and it's probably their neighbors. So we feel more at home with other Americans than we do with other believers. What that means is we tend to give the benefit of the doubt to American cultural experience. So if something's happening in American culture, we tend to give it the benefit of the doubt until it's demonstrated why it's really problematic. We don't like to be too much out of sync with American culture. We don't want to be Amish. And, you know, I like to say the more post-Christian American culture gets, the more Amish we're going to feel, and we might as well get used to it. The early church, you don't find any interest. Well, you don't find any positive interest in the early church with kind of identifying with the Greco-Roman world. And, in fact, when that is evident, it's usually in a bad way, and that's why St. Paul is saying, you know, he says to the Colossians, for instance, you know, you're understanding certain things the way your neighbors do. That's not a good thing. So I think that if we're going to be wise about the disorders of our age, that we need, first of all, to realize that that we are members of another city. Augustine talks about this in terms of the city of God and the city of man. We're citizens of the city of God, which is not identical with America. So that means that, and if we have that sense of identity, then it's easier for us to have a more detached recognition of the kinds of disorders that might be present in contemporary American culture. So I'd say that, again, the theology, I'd just say read the New Testament and look at the way in which salvation is always tied to the believer who is a member of the church. When Paul talks about spiritual gifts, he says you have these gifts for the building up of the body. This isn't for your own benefit that you have these gifts. and there are countless. I was just reading a book about the idea of a book called Transforming Conversion by Gordon Smith, and it's a book that looks at Ephesians particularly and how the letter to the Ephesians over and over assumes the corporate nature, the communal nature of our salvation. So I think that, I mean, theologically, I don't think it's hard to build that case. It was assumed by the Reformers, for sure. So the original Protestants definitely assumed that. When I was in seminary, one of my church history professors pointed out that if you were to ask most evangelicals today if they had to give up their private reading of the Bible or give up the authoritative preaching of the Word by an ordained minister of the gospel, every evangelical would give up the preaching and keep their personal Bible study. Every one of the Reformers would have given up the personal Bible study because of the fact that it was the preaching of the Word in the church that was the place where the Word of God was held. The Second Helvetic Confession, which is one of the 16th century confessions, says the preaching of the Word of God is the Word of God. Mm-hmm. So the Bible was the church's book, not the book for individual believers. And that change in modern Christianity is a profound change. And again, most of us, American evangelicals, we're heirs to that change. But I think we need to go back and ask, is that really... is it biblical? Is it really biblical? Is it what the church believed until relatively recently? And I think this is a modern... This is part of the what I would say is the disorder of modernity. It's really a modern... Modernity is about the centrality of the individual. Modernity eliminates divine law from the center of reality and puts the individual in the center of reality. And to that extent, evangelicalism is sometimes more modern than biblical. And I think, again, I'm glad to see there are a lot of evangelicals who are realizing that this is a long-standing form of cultural captivity that the church really needs to address. Now, there are some evangelicals who are going to hold on and dig their heels in and say, no, they're going to read the scriptures in that more individualistic way. I just can't imagine how you can finally do that. And I think that is almost a guarantee that Christians will become more like their non-Christian neighbors than like Christians from other cultures and in other times. So it's somewhat contentious answer.
All right, Ken Myers, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Hope that's helpful.